I'm Saruti.
I'm Hannah.
And welcome to Red Handed. Well, this week, we're going deep into the jungle. Kind of.
Are we?
We can definitely see the jungle.
Okay, fine.
From where we are.
Just checking.
It's a wild one. We are going to Brazil. Brazil's Wild West.
I've never been to there.
No, me either. Me either. When I was lucky enough to be travelling around that part of the world, I was really lucky. I went to like quite a few places in like Central and South America, but I just felt Brazil felt too big.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It felt too big to tackle as part of like a trip. Because like Bolivia and stuff, it was beautiful. Bolivia, I think, is so underrated. But I was like, 2 weeks, fine, I'll see.
Yeah.
See all the main stuff. I was like, where do you even begin with Brazil?
Yeah, I don't know.
Too much.
Mm.
I would like to go one day.
Yeah, I would like to go.
For sure. But no, have not been. But we are going there in our minds today. And honestly, everyone buckle up for one of the weirdest stories that we have told on Red Handed. Because this tale is full of gang warfare, political sabotage, hero complexes aplenty, apocalyptic prison massacres, and puppets. The story of Wallace Souza, a Brazilian Batman with an epic fall from grace, is so bizarre that it sounds like it should definitely all be made up. But it is, in fact, true. But as we'll find out in the city of Manaus, the truth can be subjective. Now, Manaus, the thing I think of when I hear of that city is, of course, 90 Day Fiancé.
How?
There is a very prominent couple, Carini and Paul, if you watch 90 Day Fiancé, and I'm talking the golden oldies, the classics of Ed and Rose and all of that. Manaus is where Weird Paul has to go to meet Carini. And it really does stand to tell you, you know, how far Manaus is. You have to understand how weird Paul is, and that the algorithm in the 90 Day universe is the weirder the guy, the further he has to go.
To find a woman who will accept him.
Yes.
Okay.
And it is the couple, if you honestly, it's just like the golden highlight moment is he goes there and he's very scared of everything. And she takes him swimming. And to be fair to him, as somebody who is scared of like dark, murky water, she takes him swimming in like the sea and it is like brown.
Right.
And like you can't see anything. And he puts a condom over his flaccid penis to get into the water because he's scared of those fish that swim up men's penises. And he thinks it's going to protect him.
Oh, no.
That's her face. That's Karina's face. And then she has to take him home and introduce him to her very macho ex-policeman father. And the man's just had a condom on his penis because he's scared of fish. It's a whole thing. Go watch it. But anyway, that is where we kind of are today. And Wallace Souza was a wildly popular anchorman. That's what you need to know about him. He was top in the, like, rankings of viewership at the time. And he hosted a crime news show that, if you have seen clips of it, and I have, I can only describe it as making Nancy Grace look like Trevor McDonald. It was so jaw-droppingly dramatic that it actually did look like it was going to turn around the city's fortunes for a good while, because crime was out of control. And people thought, as we'll go on to find out, that because he was so like finger pointy and like calling people out, that it was actually going to change something for the better. But at the center of this sprawling case is one question. Was it all just too good to be true? Was the TV show actually a smokescreen for Souza's own criminal empire? Was Wallace Souza a folk hero or a cold-blooded villain? Well, it all depends on who you ask. Welcome to the jungle.
Jumanji 2. To truly get to the bottom of this story, first we need to introduce the unique place where it all happened. The city of Manaus is the capital of Amazonas, which is Brazil's largest state. And to be fair to flaccid floppy penis man, those fish are in the Amazon.
They are.
They exist.
They are. And Manaus really is like, I know we're saying city, it is a city, but it is in the thick of the jungle. Mm. It is in the thick of the Amazon jungle. So absolutely, we are entering the jungle today. It's like, yes, there is a city, but surrounded by Amazon.
Mm-hmm. And it is a big state, the biggest one. And I'll put that into context for you. If Amazonas was a country, it would be the 16th biggest in the world.
Wow. Yeah, see, Brazil's too big. I was right.
I can't remember his name, and I know I always do. There's a Sri Lankan comedian.
Ramesh?
No. He's like, he's got like massive hair, wears cowboy boots. Anyway, he talks about Sri Lanka and like how colonized a lot and invaded and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, but I hate the Portuguese the most. Because how are you going to conquer over half the world and still be kind of poor?
They're the peeing pigs.
He's funny. I'll send him. He's very entertaining. Anyway, perched at the edge of the mighty Amazon River and its sprawling rainforest beyond, the city itself is largely only accessible by boat or air.
Mm-hmm.
And one might consider it the last seat of civilization before it gets really, really jungly. And there is a danger lurking in that jungle. Jaguars in the shadows, venomous spiders in your boots, something slithering just out of sight to bite you on the vagina through the toilet.
For sure. Primetime toilet snake territory.
But that's not all to fear. This is shocking. In 2022, a survey ranked Manaus as the 21st most dangerous city on the planet. And if you think crime in London is bad, we've got a murder rate here about 1.5 homicides per 100,000 people. In Manaus, the figure leaps to 48 murders per 100,000 people. That's a lot.
Yikes.
I did see, this has been doing the rounds. At the moment, there was an influencer who was in Brazil traveling, and she stays in a hostel in the favelas and like makes this video being like, I just feel really unsafe. And they're like, yeah, bitch.
Yeah.
What did you think was going to happen?
I don't know. I don't know why you'd be shocked by that. I think I was in Guatemala City, and at the time, I think Guatemala City was like a second or third most dangerous city in the world. And it was the only ever hostel that I have stayed in where the door was locked from the inside, like latched from the inside. And if anybody ever knocked at the door, you had to go get a member of staff to come and open it. You weren't allowed to open it yourself. And I was like, it's good to be safe.
Mm-hmm. So with all of that in mind, and because we're not silly travel influencers, Manaus doesn't really have that much of a tourism population. Not many people moving through there.
Nah, just men looking for Brazilian women to marry. But why, other than all of these obvious reasons, is Manaus such a fucking scary place? Why is the crime so high, I guess we should say? Well, Manaus's location on the banks of the Amazon River make it a very strategic transit point for drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, of course, drugs that are flowing in from neighboring countries like Colombia, Peru, and Bolivia. And when illicit plantations growing, is it cacao?
Welcome to What Else Don't I Know with Hannah Maguire. I have never known how to pronounce it, and I've been too scared to ask my entire life. I don't know.
Cacao. Let's go with that.
Okay.
Growing cacao. You know what we're talking about. It's obviously the natural leaf that is used as the base for making cocaine. When these sort of illicit plantations started springing up in the Amazon basin from the 1980s onwards, it put Manaus even more firmly on the map as a hotbed of drug trade activity. We've talked about the Darien Gap, which is obviously that section of the jungle that sort of is the only break in that kind of huge Pan-American highway that runs all the way from like the tippity-top most of like the Americas all the way down to like Patagonia. And that's the only break. And that's because the authorities literally cannot get into that jungle to continue the highway because it is so controlled by drugs and by gangs and whatnot. And there was a guy who was going to make a documentary about him crossing the Darien Gap, and it was like getting a lot of hype about it. People were like super excited, and then he just quietly cancelled it because he was like,
I thought you were like, and then he was shot
and quietly cancelled. He was like, nah, this is
well, when he realized that it's not a fucking joke, and there's a reason no one's done
it's not gonna happen. So yeah, Manaus, very much along the same lines. And the city fell under the grip of organized crime groups fighting for control of drug routes, sparking, as you can imagine, pretty bloody turf wars that turned the streets into an absolute battleground. Widespread police corruption also meant that the authorities often turned a blind eye. And socioeconomic researcher Luis Antonio Nascimento, which is just the beginning of Hannah and I butchering several Brazilian Portuguese names today, you are welcome, describes a culture of violence that's woven into the city's very DNA. Moreover, Manaus in the late 20th century was marked by extreme poverty for a large proportion of its citizens. It's a far cry from its glory days between 1870 and 1910, when merchants made their fortunes during the so-called rubber boom, and the city of Manaus was actually considered one of the richest in the world at that time. But by the 1990s, with bullets flying everywhere and any backbones among the local government nowhere to be found, the people of Manaus were holding out for a hero. And then, seemingly, one came along. Wallace Sulzer. I believe.
Thank you so much. His full name is Francisco Wallace Cavalcante de Sousa. No, G. Sousa. What's hard, right?
Dij.
It looks like Spanish.
Yeah.
It ain't.
Looks like Spanish.
It's so difficult to pronounce it.
Looks like Spanish, sounds like Russian.
Mm.
Well, not even Russian, but like, it sounds very like Eastern European, I think, with Portuguese.
I agree. I've heard people say it sounds like Russian before.
Yeah.
I'll try again. Francisco Wallace Cavalcante de Sousa. No one's going to tell me I'm wrong because I won't listen. Thank you. He was born with all of them names in Manaus in 1958 into a close-knit family. He had a personal score to settle with the drug dealers who were running riot in his hometown. His brother, Ulysses, struggled with addiction and ultimately lost his life to drugs. And Wallace was furious and vowed to avenge his brother one day. With the moral mission of cleaning up the mean streets of Manaus, Wallace joined the military police in 1976. But he was kicked out after 8 years for his alleged involvement in a gasoline embezzlement scheme.
No further details to be found.
No. The only thing I can imagine is that episode of Always Sunny where they just buy loads of petrol and try and sell it door to door.
Genius. Genius.
I think that's what I'm choosing to believe. Anyway, Wallace was not going to let his crime-fighting ambitions die because of one little setback and one little big crime that he did. He became a journalist instead. He started out working on regional radio shows before launching his own regional crime show in 1996. And just like that, Canal Livre, which means free channel, was born.
Excellent. I also do just want to clarify for people who are like, you should try harder with your pronunciations. They are written out phonetically for us. So we've not done the work to try hard. It's just quite intimidating to get it right.
Yeah.
And quite hard. But we're going to continue. How are we saying that? Canal Livre. Mm. Let's go with that. So how can we describe this particular show? Think Crime Watch meets Jerry Springer via Anton Deck Saturday Night Takeaway or SNL, and maybe, just maybe, you're halfway there. Now, while the show's principal focus was crime coverage, it also featured entertainment. Producer Victor Hugo de Paula admitted it was a, quote, totally chaotic and spontaneous show where anything could happen. Segments could vary from dancing girls to warring families tearing each other's hair out over petty disputes in the studio audience. And if you're wondering what on earth we were talking about at the start as to why puppets were involved, well, amid the chaos, a puppet named Galerito A parody of wannabe gangsters wearing gold chains and streetwear would crack dirty jokes and had a running gag of winding up the stage entertainer. And there is actually footage out there on the internet of a physical fight involving Gallery Toad the Puppet and, like, people in the audience that was revived and actually spread as a viral meme online in the late noughties. And you honestly have to watch it to believe it. It is. It's quite the situation. Is he the puppet? Where's the puppet? Just a guy doing the bachata. Where is it? Let's get to the fight. Oh my god. Oh my god. Well, I think I've seen enough. Somebody is still holding onto the puppet, fighting the crowd with it.
Okay.
So the Times calls it a madcap variety show intercut with brutal murders. And I think that's pretty much all you need to know. Basically, it's absolutely batshit fucking crazy. You know the episode of The Simpsons where they go to Brazil to look for the little lost orphan boy?
Oh, yeah.
And they're just like, everything is like on TV, it's like hypersexualized and there's fights. That is what this is.
It's
accurate.
I'm genuinely lost for words. Mm-hmm. That's the most bizarre thing I've ever seen.
Well, there you go.
Ugh. Anyway, who gives a shit what I think? Because the locals could not get enough of Can I Live Here. It was a hit. Everybody dropped what they were doing every lunchtime to tune in to the latest episode.
Can I just also say?
Yes.
I was not expecting it to be a midday show. It feels like a 10 p.m. kind of show. Lunchtime? Everyone drops what they're doing at lunchtime to watch this fucking show.
I mean, maybe.
Nothing about that scream daytime TV.
Jerry Springer's daytime TV.
Do you know what? Fair enough.
And to be fair, the first time I ever watched Jerry Springer, I couldn't believe. I had no way of processing what I was watching.
No. I actually did recently watch like a behind the scenes documentary of Jerry Springer and how it came together. And he's actually a really funny guy.
Oh, I think Jerry Springer's very smart.
He's very smart. He's really talented. He's very funny. And they were like, the show was completely different at the start. And then the producers were the ones who were like, Jerry Springer, he is comedic. Like, we can do more with this. And then like turned it into what it is. But yeah, it was genius for its time, for sure.
And at center stage of this daytime television was not Jerry Springer. Did he ever get governor of California?
Oh, I don't think
he
so.
He definitely ran. Wallace was center stage. He captivated audiences with his passionate anti-crime rants and shocking coverage of murders, drug raids, and arrests around the city. 60 Minutes' Carl Stefanovic described Manaus as a hell for criminals, but heaven for crime reporters chasing the next shocking story. And if Manaus was heaven, Wallace Salza was God.
Mm.
Investigative journalist Paola Taifi remembers that Carne Livre always had the inside scoop. And when she says inside, she quite literally means it. Wallace and his crew didn't just report on crimes from the sidelines. They took their viewers right into the heart of the action. Their cameras captured gruesome, uncensored footage of gangland executions, often arriving at crime scenes before the police to broadcast all of the gory details. And we're talking quite seriously gory. There's blood flowing into the streets, close-ups of gunshots and stab wounds, zooming in on dumped bodies who hadn't even been officially identified yet, and even victims still clinging to life before dying on camera.
Yeah, I think to us, that is quite shocking.
Yeah.
But as somebody who spent every summer in India, watching the news with her grandparents, can say standard business, standard protocol. Like some of the things I saw on like just the news at 10 and what was being broadcast. It wasn't even like this sort of, you know, madcap show, just the news at 10. I was like, I cannot believe they're showing that. Absolutely horrific. There is one that is like seared into my brain, and it was It was awful. It was like this psychiatric hospital. But hospital seems a stretch because it doesn't feel like they were actually trying to help these people. They basically just kept them all chained up because they just like couldn't handle it. Like think that crazy Hungarian or Romanian orphanage situation, basically like that, but with adults. And a fire broke out and everyone who was working there just fled. And all of these people who had been chained up just burned to death. God. And there was all this footage of their burned bodies, burned, chained up bodies on the news. And I was just like, how am I seeing this? I like literally can still visualize it in my head. So yeah, I think while it's quite shocking for us, and while this definitely wasn't like run of the mill for what was going on in Brazil, the reason everybody was watching it without asking so many questions is like, it just probably wouldn't have been as unbelievable that it was being shown. And also because they live in a city with such high levels of crime, most people are probably seeing horrible crimes all the time. Mm-hmm. That it probably was just refreshing. And I say that with like a cringe, to have a news channel that was just reporting it as it was in many ways. But yeah, it's still hard for us to believe that this stuff made it onto the screen. But like I said, maybe in the national context at the time, not that shocking. Apparently Brazilian TV, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, was notorious for crossing ethical lines when it came to sensational coverage. And we have an example. There is a pretty famous case in Brazil called the Eloa case, which took place in Sao Paulo in 2008. And it was when a 15-year-old girl named Eloa Pimentel was held hostage for 100 hours by her older ex-boyfriend. The police's bungling hostage negotiations were exacerbated by an absolute media frenzy, with reporters swarming the scene and even calling the kidnapper in order to rile him up on air. Tragically, and probably somewhat predictably, Eloa didn't make it out alive. And Canal Livre wasn't much different. It thrived on airing the most shocking footage it could possibly get its hands on. But even in this landscape at that time in Brazil, Wallace Souza stood out for his bravery and also his bravado. No matter how dangerous the scene, Wallace would be there with his camera crew, facing off the violent criminals and denouncing them on TV. Something that nobody in Manaus had ever dared to do before.
With time, people came to see Wallace Souza as a hardline crusader against crime. Because Wallace wasn't satisfied with just showing the gang violence, he wanted to do something about it. And the authorities seemed unable or unwilling to even try. Wallace didn't hide his vitriol towards drug traffickers. He declared that they made him sick and only deserved bullets in the grave. After a while, he brought in his brothers, Carlos and Fausto, as co-hosts, and the trio were swiftly nicknamed the Courage Brothers and built a reputation of standing up for the public.
And you can see why that would be incredibly, like, alluring.
Absolutely.
For the people in Manaus to feel like the authorities are corrupt, they're doing nothing, drug dealers are running our city, there's nothing we can do. And finally, here is this man or this group of men who are brave enough to name and shame them, put their faces on the screen, call them out, say that they're destroying our country and destroying our families and destroying people's lives. And you can absolutely see it's not just like this sick fascination with the sensationalist crime that he's reporting. It's the fact that he's presenting himself as some sort of vigilante.
Yeah, and I think it's important that Manaus is quite isolated. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be its own thing. And then not many people are coming and going. So it's going to be, there's going to be a camaraderie there that places that possibly have a bit more of a transient population that are more coming and going, not sort of staying forever, might be a bit different. And as it turned out, Canal Livre became a sort of emergency hotline, with Wallace as its unofficial sheriff. In many cases, citizens started to call the show with tips about a shooting that they just witnessed, rather than involving the authorities, which sounds absolutely mad, but I can understand why.
Mm-hmm.
And partially, that's because the camera crews would get there faster than the police would, but also probably something to do with people trusting Wallace Souza more than they trusted the police.
And they had good reason. Brazil's military police force does not have the best track record. A significant portion of gun violence in the country's favelas comes from officers opening fire, often catching innocent civilians in the crossfire. So, with this in mind, it makes sense that the people turn to Wallace as their potential saviour. And The Guardian wrote about this case and noted the following. He seems progressively to have assumed the functions of the government, police, welfare system, and judiciary, until he becomes a mix of populist demagogue and vigilante enforcer. Making bold declarations like, "Manaus cannot become a lawless land," Wallace appeared to incite the community to rebellion against the fear and complacency that had been the status quo for too long. With Wallace leading this moral crusade, could things really change?
It certainly felt that way. With his fearless approach to naming and shaming local drug barons, Wallace wielded real power, not just over the public, but over the gangs themselves. According to the show's cameraman, Jose Nielsen Guerrero, dealers would flee the scene when Wallace and his crew showed up. They may not have been afraid of the police, but they were afraid of Wallace Sulzer.
No wonder he was so power mad. Imagine turning up to like a gangland crime and drug barons are fleeing from your camera.
Mm-hmm. And Canal Libre became more than just a crime show. It offered a beacon of hope amid the bleak reality of life for Manaus' poorest citizens. The show ran charity segments where struggling families could appeal for help and receive money and food. Sulzer even personally paid university tuition fees for members of his crew. Producer Victor Hugo attributes Canal Libre's success to that social focus. With the government failing to support this remote and deprived region of Brazil, Wallace stepped up to fill the void, not just as a journalist, but as a leader and a protector.
But with his star on the rise, moving into politics was a natural next step for Wallace. In Brazil, it is definitely pretty common for celebs to transition into politics and keep their former careers still. So We see that in other parts of the world. Especially, definitely, you know, I can speak to India. There's a lot of actors that transition straight into politics. And similarly to Brazil, they don't have to give up their initial career in order to be able to do it. So in, for example, the US, if you want to become, apparently, if you want to become more integrated into politics and you are like running this sort of crime show, you would have to give up that crime show because I think there's something along the lines of you can use that show to like campaign for yourself.
And also, I think if I'm looking at an elected official who is supposed to be serving me, the voter, why aren't you doing that all the time?
Exactly.
That doesn't make sense.
But Wallace here kept his job on the TV show and he ran for politics. And he was actually elected to the State Legislative Assembly as a congressman in 2000. And to call it a landslide victory would definitely be putting it mildly. Wallace Sulzer broke records for each of his three elected terms, becoming proportionally the most voted for politician in Brazil.
Wow.
And he's been dubbed a Brazilian combination of David Attenborough, Sherlock Holmes and Barack Obama. And just a little bit of foreshadowing here. Also, Jake Gyllenhaal's character from Nightcrawler. So, keeping it in the family, as you would, the other Courage brothers were also elected as local officials in various posts, including mayor of Manaus for his brother Carlos.
As a politician, Wallace Sulzer continued building his reputation as a champion of the people. He wasn't just calling out drug dealers anymore. He was criticizing the government. He showed up the powers that be by questioning why they weren't doing more to crack down on notorious organized crime groups, like the Family of the North, the FDN for short. And he also exposed the mayor of Kuari, an impoverished rural town, rich with oil fields that the community never saw a penny of. And he called out that mayor for embezzling public funds, which he quite obviously was doing. An investigation ended up uncovering that the man in question, Adele Pinheiro, had also been running a town-wide paedophile ring.
Yeah, it's things like this, right? I mean, Wallace Sulzer, he's like pointing fingers, he's taking names, he's kicking ass, and he's calling out other officials like this mayor. Mm-hmm. And he's only calling them out for embezzlement, as if that's not bad enough. And then when the people find out he's also running a fucking secret paedophile ring, it is, again, further cementing everybody's belief that all these officials are corrupt And Wallace Sulza is the only one to be trusted. It's all a huge conspiracy. They're out to just exploit. And this is how, and he's not wrong, but as we go on to some issues. But yeah, it's just every finger point is just further cementing him as this hero of the people.
And even though he was pulling off all of these really big ticket policies, he never ever quit his day job. Wallace Sulza carried on hosting Count Olivera every day. So, you know, tidy your room. Yeah. You have the same amount of hours in a day as Wallace Sulza. Anyway, in a 2005 episode of Count Olivera, Wallace bravely swapped places with a family held hostage by drug dealers who said that they refused to negotiate with anyone but Wallace Sulza. And as the kidnappers drove off with him, it did look like the congressman was in quite a difficult, sticky, possibly fatal situation. But he walked away totally unharmed because the gang changed their minds.
I think there was some calculation there that they made that killing him is not going to make them particularly popular. Also, wouldn't be surprised if he just threw some money at them.
I'm wondering if the whole thing was just a bit made-uppy, a bit Jerry Springer, a bit produced.
Also very possible.
And of course, it was all caught on camera and aired on Count Olivera. And this hostage switcheroo gave Wallace Sulza another enormous image boost. People were impressed to see a politician risking his own life to save other people.
But for all his popularity, Wallace was all too aware that his work could certainly earn him some powerful enemies. Wallace Sulza, much like a Paul from 90 Day Fiancé, took to riding around in a bulletproof car. Paul only had a bulletproof vest that everybody laughed at, but given this whole episode, I think, you know, man's got a point. So yeah, Wallace would drive around in this bulletproof car with hired security and describe himself as one of the most threatened men in the state. If the day ever came, a lot of people would be celebrating Wallace Sulza's downfall, not least the drug traffickers that he'd helped put behind bars by exposing them on TV. And presumably also all those politicians that he's pointing the finger at and, you know, rocking the boat, rocking the corruption boat. They're going to be pretty happy if he is eventually offed. And then in 2008, along came a man named Moa. To give him his full name, because apparently I have to, it is Moacir Jorge Pereira. And he was simply known, thankfully, as Moa, which is what I will be calling him moving forward. And he was a former military police officer who'd gone over to the dark side by moonlighting for the organized crime gangs. He was arrested in 2008 as part of a routine investigation into his crimes and was wanted for a whopping 9 murders. Now, at first, Moa was weirdly calm. He kept confidently claiming that his boss would sort things out for him. But when that didn't materialise, Moa began to sweat. He knew that a stint in jail would mean almost certain death, since he'd pissed off quite a few people inside. And we don't need to tell you this, but in Brazil, prison gangs are no joke. PCC, a citywide gang who are the sworn rivals of the FDN in Manaus, were actually originally formed at a high-security penitentiary in Sao Paulo. Being behind bars doesn't do much to curb these guys', you know, murderous ambitions. In fact, prisons are pretty much their whole base of operations. So, as Moa started panicking, he also started talking. And then came the bombshell. Moa's alleged boss, the man who had hired him to commit those 9 murders he was being accused of, was none other than local hero, aka Jake Gyllenhaal from Nightcrawler, Wallace Sulza.
Moa claimed that Wallace personally ordered him to wreak havoc on the city by committing the murders of multiple notorious drug traffickers, 5 of which were actually covered on Count Olivera in all of their grisly glory. And that's not even the most mental bit. The motive was to boost the ratings of Count Olivera.
Yeah. So when people ask us, I am scared you're going to run out of cases.
No.
Wale Sousa is obviously in a different position where he's like, he needs like live, he needs like current. It's a news, crime news show. He's like, even in a city where they have 48 murders per 100,000 people, he's like, should we just, you know, speed things along a little bit?
I am always interested when that question gets asked of like, you know, are you worried that you're going to run out? How quickly people will jump to a Wale Sousa situation. Like, but you could do that and then you could cut. I'm like, what? That's not a normal thing to say. But it's almost always the next step in that conversation.
Yeah, we're not going to do it.
Or maybe I already have. Anyway.
We'd be doing more investigative. If we start doing more investigative long form pieces, then get suspicious. Because that shit's hard. And the only way I'm doing it is if I literally did it myself and know all of the answers.
Cut to this being played back in a court of law. Anyway, the accusation was that Wale Sousa calculatedly plotted to satisfy his increasingly bloodthirsty viewer base with the shocking inside scoop that they hungered for. Lead detective Deva Nielsen Calvacanchi agreed that this was almost certainly murder for ratings.
Yeah. And look, there is a Netflix documentary on this show called Killer Ratings.
Very good.
Bravo. Bravo.
And according to Deva Nielsen, the simple reason that Carnalivo was always the first at the scene of the crime was because they knew that they were going to happen because they had ordered the hits themselves.
That'll do it.
And he called Canalivre a massive smokescreen for Wallace's criminal enterprise. Wallace was just a jaguar in sheep's clothing, and his whole Defender of the People Act was a big fat lie.
So as you can imagine, the allegations sent shockwaves through Manaus. Public attention returned to a previous clip from Canalivre, which showed the reporter approaching a still-burning body in a jungle clearing, remarking that it smelled like a barbecue. Shocking as the footage was, even more troubling questions now had to be asked in light of the recent allegations against Wallace. Because in the clip, the reporter reels off facts like the sex of the victim, the fact that they were killed in the early hours of the morning, and that they had been shot multiple times. But if Wallace had just simply stumbled upon this burning corpse, how on earth could he have known that? It's good questions. It's good questions. And also, how was Wallace there in the first place, long before the police even knew of this crime? A new and disturbing answer was starting to materialise, that maybe Carnalivre knew precisely because they had put the body there. Though I can also see a world in which he's just being framed by the police. As in, or not that that's what happened. That's not what happened. But a world in which people believe that's what's happening, right? Because the prosecution are going after him there.
Okay, I see.
Moa said, this guy Moa, who we arrested for 9 murders, had said, you actually paid him to do these murders. And, you know, Wale Sousa, he's there pointing fingers at all these corrupt government officials, mm-hmm. including probably, you know, the judiciary system. And I could see a world in which people are like, you're just trying to shut him up.
Yeah, I can see that world. I don't live there.
No.
But it was a bitter pill for Wale Sousa's fans to swallow. After all, he'd done so much to stamp out crime in their community. It couldn't be possible that he was actually a drug trafficking kingpin himself. And naturally, Wale Sousa denied absolutely everything. He insisted that this was an elaborate smear campaign orchestrated by his political rivals, who saw him as a threat to the corrupt establishment. I mean, it does write itself.
That's what I'd say.
Yeah.
If this is being played in a court. Just trying to make some content here.
And Sousa claimed that he'd never even met this Moa character. And that might have worked to take a little bit of the heat off. If it wasn't for the discovery of a photo, which was anonymously delivered to the police station, that showed Wale Sousa and Moa chilling in the pool together. at Wallace's house.
Oh, dear. Wallace.
Don't lie about easily provable things. Mm. And that photo had some pretty dodgy tan lines in it and even dodgier implications for Wallace Sulzer, who was now flailing like a man in seriously hot water. Left with no choice, he admitted that, yes, he did know Moa, but he only knew him as Jorge, a friend of his eldest son, Rafael.
I actually think it's Jorge.
Jorge?
In Brazilian Portuguese.
I don't know. I can't keep up.
It's hard. Jorge with a J.
And Wallace swore that there was absolutely no business relationship between him and Moa and no criminal orders. But Sulzer's credibility was completely gone, and it had left him very vulnerable.
A task force called Operation Centurion was assembled to investigate Wallace and 15 others, including members of the military police. Led by the intelligence secretary for Amazonas, Tomás Vasconcelos, they came down hard on Wallace with a raft of damning allegations. Wiretaps of Wallace's conversations with his close friend, police chief Colonel Felipe Arce, revealed the two had a habit of leaking intel on criminals and investigations, which, if nothing else, explained how Carna Livre always seemed to have the tea about local crimes. But that was just the tip of the dirty, dirty iceberg. Because investigators also found evidence suggesting that Wallace, his son Rafael, and Colonel Arce had actually plotted to assassinate a local judge. It looked like they had hired a hitman, Luis Pulgar, to carry it out, and that when Luis had refused and threatened to talk, they had ordered his execution, which was carried out in a butcher shop in 2008. And it didn't stop there. The task force alleged that Wallace wasn't just ordering these hits, he was taking over the very turf of the gangs that he drove out and keeping their operations running under his own control. So this, right, if you are the kind of person that would like, well, I can get on board with the fact that he's some sort of vigilante, you know, hit orderer of drug dealers and cartel bosses and whatever, because you're like, clean up those streets. The police aren't doing it. Let's get rid of them. If you are a person who can vibe with that, and I'm not completely unsympathetic to that point of view, although obviously extrajudicial killings problematic, just to have this on tape, it is the fact that he doesn't then shut down the drugs operations.
Yeah.
He's like, yummy, 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 yummy. I'll take that.
Yeah. I think it's Robin Hood is one thing, but you ain't taking from the rich and giving to the poor.
Yeah. He's just like, kill you, I take.
Kill you, now and I'm you rich. Can keep all your drugs, and please put them back on the streets.
Yeah.
Here is some cash.
Exactly.
Things were not looking good for Wallace Sulzer. But in Manaus, legal processes are rarely smooth sailing. The task force's investigation was dogged by contradicting statements from Moa, whose wife began claiming that he had been tortured by goons from Amazonas intelligence services and forced to lie, but she would say that, wouldn't she?
Mm, it's worth saying.
And it's also worth saying that the torture story emerged after an explosion tore through the police station where Moa was being held in solitary confinement. A lot of people believed that explosion to be a targeted attack on Moa's life, and he managed to scrape through unscathed, but only just. So, was Mrs. Moa telling the truth about him being tortured? Or was this a family under pressure from reprisal attempts from Wallace Sulzer's gang?
Both. All of it.
Things can be two things.
Everything. In this story, is probably everything, because everyone is up to corruption.
Yeah. And ultimately, Moa wasn't a credible witness. But that didn't really matter to the task force.
After obtaining a warrant for the Sulzer family home, police officers discovered an absolute gold mine of evidence in a safe kept in Rafael's room, containing an equivalent of $15,000, an insane amount of firearms and ammunition, and a handwritten list of names that appeared to show the hierarchy of Wallace's criminal organization. Why? Why have you got that? I always find the word that kind of chart is very funny. It's like an organogram. Organogram is
that? I've never heard that in my life.
Yeah, so it's called an organogram. And it is basically when you have this little chart of like Wallace Sulza at the top and then his henchmen.
And it's okay.
Like the hierarchy. And I remember when I was at my old job and we got Slack for the first time. And like usually, you know, if you work in like a big company or like a company with more than like 10 people, you will have an organogram on Slack. It suggests that you do so that new people, when they join, you can like see who's more senior than who. But it always just made me laugh.
Organogram. Well, I did not know that.
There you
Thank
go.
You for enlightening me.
Wallace Sulza, for some reason, has got his organogram handwritten and buried in a safe under his son's fucking floorboards.
Now, why would you ever need that?
Don't know. Just why do you need to keep track of that? Now, Raphael actually claimed that he'd drawn it up with his lawyer to illustrate the accusations they were facing. But investigators took it as proof. So he's saying, oh, I just doodled it with my lawyer to get clear in my head what we're being accused of. What we're being accused of, like, doing in our criminal organization, who they're saying is in the hierarchy. But no, it was just a thought activity.
That I put in a safe.
Yes. Which is where I keep all of my doodles. And in a eureka moment, more discoveries were made. Specifically, spent shell casings were found in the safe that allegedly matched the crime scene of a murder from January 2007 of the gangster known as Bebe Chineo, nicknamed because he was the son of a major kingpin named Bebeto. Now, Bebe Chineo's bloody corpse had actually featured on Carne Libre, slumped over the steering wheel of his car just moments after his execution. The seemingly incontrovertible evidence found in the Sulza home cemented Wallace's guilt in the task force's eyes. Again, why are you fucking saving that?
He just doesn't really seem to be trying. But I think, like, as in trying to get away with it.
Uh-huh.
But I think he has evidently, well, it would appear that he has been getting away with this for quite some time. So I think he just didn't think they were ever going to catch him.
No, and I honestly think if he hadn't been pointing the finger at the police being corrupt and all sorts, if he'd just been killing drug dealers and then filming it, he'd have got away with it. Don't point the finger at the police, because that's when they're going to come get you. And a police officer at the scene said Wallace appeared physically crushed when they made these discoveries, while still insisting that one day he'd become the secretary of security himself and prove the truth.
The net was closing in on Wallace Sulza, who was still valiantly fighting to clear his name. And as an elected congressman, he had legislative immunity. For now.
What the fuck?
That seems like that's not fine. I feel like that needs to be reviewed.
Oh my God.
At first, his colleagues in the Legislative Assembly pledged their support for Wallace Sulza. But the more the evidence stacked up, the more difficult it was to do that, and the more public and private confidence in Wallace Sulza began to crumble. In a passionate speech he delivered to his elected colleagues, Wallace Sulza insisted that he was being framed in the greatest political persecution ever seen in this state. He argued that his obvious ambitions to become the Amazonas Secretary of Security ultimately made him too big of a threat and meant that his political rivals would do anything to discredit him. Despite this last-ditch attempt, Wallace Sulza was ultimately impeached by an ethics committee in October 2009. And that impeachment meant that he was stripped of his legislative immunity and immediately slapped with multiple charges, including ordering the murder of five drug dealers and criminals between 2007 and 2009, involvement in drug trafficking, and the formation of a criminal gang.
Following his impeachment, Wallace went on the run for several days, during which time the state borders were shut and roadblocks were set up around the city of Manaus. After a few days of hiding out at his ex-wife's house, Wallace ultimately handed himself in to face the music with a massive security motorcade. It's going down, going down. with a big bang.
Yeah, you have to.
Now, we have to understand that Wallace Sulzer, for him, prison would have been an absolutely terrifying prospect. After all, he was probably the one indirectly responsible for putting half of those inmates behind those bars.
I hadn't thought of that.
And they probably weren't best pleased about it.
Mm.
But Daniel Bogoda, director of the Killer Ratings Netflix documentary that we talked about, believes the death of Wallace's reputation was even more of a devastating consequence for him than the idea of being beaten to death in prison.
Oh, I completely agree with that.
Daniel actually describes Wallace Sulzer as, quote, a man who clearly wanted to be loved. I think that is true. I think he does scream of a man who is possibly feeling quite empty. There's a lot of like self-aggrandizement. I'm the most persecuted man. I'm the most threatened man. I have to be. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying he wasn't all of those things. I'm sure there was a lot of people out there who were very pissed off at him. But it's constantly him putting himself at the top level of whether it is success or persecution. And I think he absolutely loved all of the attention that he was getting. Because once he got elected into the Legislative Assembly, if he really just cared about stamping down on crime, he could have stepped away from the show and just dedicated all of his time to doing that. But he doesn't. He's got to keep the show going. And I also think this idea of this scandal turning him from a hero into absolutely a global laughingstock. Because outside of Brazil, I don't think Wallace Sulzer's name was particularly well known. But after he was arrested, it's too compelling a story for it not to spread everywhere else. And suddenly now he's not this god and this hero and this savior of the people. He's like a supervillain who's laughed at. Barely even a supervillain. A villain who's laughed at. And I think that's something that was possibly quite difficult for him to bear.
I think that is his worst nightmare.
100%. And the adulation that he was getting from the crowds now turned to jeers, because as the tide of public opinion turned on Wallace, people would actually line the streets and scream, "Jail Wallace the bastard," and throw him in a cage. He had definitely gone from the people's champion to their enemy. And he was slowly marching towards a more hostile audience than he'd ever faced. And I think people are so pissed off with him because he set himself up to be the opposite of all these corrupt, self-enriching people who were in power. And they all obviously felt incredibly exploited. I don't think they're particularly sad that he was murdering drug dealers, but I think it's obviously the lies and that he kept all those operations running for himself.
Awaiting trial, Wallace Sulzer was placed, quite sensibly, in a solitary cell for his own protection. And the close-knit crew from Carne Livre went to visit him all the time in a show of solidarity. But when they went to visit him, they were met with a broken man who begged his former crewmates not to give up on proving his innocence. Didn't work.
No.
The first charge pursued by the court was the 2007 murder of a notorious drug trafficker named Kakula, who Moa claimed he was hired to bump off by Sosa and his son. Interestingly, the motive in this case was revenge and not ratings. And that's because Kakula was the drug dealer who allegedly got Wallace's beloved brother Ulysses hooked on drugs in the first place. And after that deed was done, Moa claims that Rafael reported back to his dad that he had avenged his uncle's death, to which Wallace smiled, "That's my boy."
Uh-oh. And a new witness was now adding credence to the prosecution's claims. Giselle Vaz, a former reporter from Carne Livre, was the one loose link in the team who wasn't insisting Wallace was some sort of wrongly accused patsy. Instead, Giselle revealed some shocking details of what life was apparently really like behind the scenes of the show. She claimed that she had witnessed multiple fake drugs bust setups, where drugs were planted at scenes, as well as people being tortured into making confessions through a method referred to ominously as the bag.
Oh no, I don't like that at all.
And, is basically exactly what it says on the tin. They'd put a plastic bag on the person's head until they couldn't breathe anymore and eventually made a confession. And on at least one occasion, Giselle says, Wallace euphemistically said somebody had gone to the bag and died this way. Giselle also confirmed that Moa was indeed Wallace's personal security guard. who always went with him on his operations. As you can imagine, Giselle's testimony blew a massive hole in Wallace's case, and he now faced a mountain of evidence and had little to defend himself with at trial.
Does she host the show now? Possibly. Wallace Sulzer, however, never made it that far. He had had chronic health problems for years, suffering from the rare liver condition, Budd-Chiari syndrome, where the hepatic veins are obstructed, which causes fluid buildup. And he doesn't look like a well man, does he? He was so unwell that on medical grounds, he was excused from attending his own trial, and his health continued to deteriorate. He was flown to Sao Paulo in 2010 for specialist treatment. Mysterious billboards were erected around Manaus by his supporters, showing photographs of a frail and emaciated Wallace Sulzer, asking, "How much is a life worth? Fucking hell." Wallace Sulzer died on the 27th of July 2010, age 51. His lawyer, Francisco Bolero, said that this was an assassination. It was the investigation, not his dodgy liver, that killed Wallace Sulzer. Wallace's body was flown back to Manaus for a funeral with over 5,000 grief-stricken admirers. And in death, he became kind of a martyr, which is probably what he would always want to, but he's dead, so he doesn't know that. There would never be a legal closure to his case. All criminal charges against him were dropped when he died.
But the investigations into others implicated in Wallace's alleged crime ring did continue. And fair warning, the Brazilian legal system is incredibly confusing. Cases seem to drag on for years and years and years, with countless interruptions and things getting overturned before they're reviewed again later. Like, surprise, bitch, like, it's very, very, very confusing. But in terms of outcomes for the major players on Team Wallace, this is what we do know. His producer at Carne Livre, a woman named Vanessa Lima, was targeted by the task force after she publicly accused the head of this task force of witness intimidation and torture. And the thing is, I can believe that she's lying. I can also believe that that happened.
Mm-hmm.
This is the problem with this case, that everyone is so corrupt and everyone is lying all the time, that it's kind of like a choose your own adventure if you want to believe.
Yeah.
And you're kind of right, whatever you do.
Mm.
Now, Vanessa was actually imprisoned for several months before ultimately being acquitted in 2019. Now, Wallace's brothers, Carlos and Fausta, were also eventually acquitted of their charges for drug trafficking in 2021 after what they described as 12 years of intense suffering. The judge ruled that the evidence was not robust enough to convict them, as it was largely based on wiretap conversations and hearsay rather than solid proof. But Wallace's son, Rafael, was not quite so lucky. He was sentenced to 17 years in prison for a host of charges, including drug trafficking, illegal firearms possession, and masterminding the 2007 murder of Kajula, which bizarrely Moa was acquitted for, despite being the one who allegedly pulled the trigger. Rafael actually went on to serve 15 years in prison before his eventual release just last year in 2024. He also faced several charges for the murder of Luis Pulga, the would-be assassin from the alleged plot to kill the judge in 2008, and also the 2007 murder of the gangster Bementinho. But these have all been overturned more times than we've changed our fucking socks this week. So who the hell knows if Rafael will ever actually be convicted of those?
And if you're feeling confused, listener, me too. It's a nightmare to unpick all of this. It's so complicated. But what about Moa, the whistleblower who started it all? His story was brought to a close 7 years after Wallace Sulzer's death, in possibly the most fucked up part of this entire saga. In the early hours of New Year's Day 2017, Anicio Shobim Penitentiary Complex turned into an unexpected rave. The Family of the North, or the FDN, organised crime group, had taken over the prison, paying for the spectacular fireworks to light up the skies above Manaus, whilst over 1,000 inmates danced to Brazilian funk music with their loved ones inside the walls. And just a few hours later, absolute carnage began. FDN members declared war on their rival gang, the PCC, and butchered them with smuggled knives and guns as well. Decapitated bodies piled high in scenes that Danielle Bugardo describes as apocalyptic. And that is how it sounds. 56 inmates were massacred. But the FDN members had a separate bone to pick with Moa, who they considered to be the biggest rat of all. They couldn't behead him and dismember him because he was in an isolated cell. So instead, they reached through the bars and set fire to his mattress, burning him alive. And Moa's gruesome death marked the final chapter in the Wallace-Sulzer affair. That is mad.
Yeah.
Everything just feels like it's going to kick off any second from any angle, and you don't know which one.
Yes. I think that sums up everything you need to know about this case. And still, the case today sparks intense debate in Amazonas. Judge Mirza Telma Cunha, who presided over his short-lived trial, insists there is no doubt of Wallace Sulzer's guilt. But many in the community still hold on to the belief that Wallace was indeed framed. His longtime friend and Carne Livre producer, Victor Hugo, calls the whole thing a political farce, arguing that Wallace was made a scapegoat for crossing the wrong people in power. And Wallace's youngest son, confusingly also named Wallace, agrees.
Willis.
Oh, Willis. Sorry.
Willis just changed one letter.
Willis. According to Willis, his dad was persecuted by a well-connected coward who hid in the shadows and used dirty tricks to smear his father's reputation, rather than fighting him face to face. And all fingers point at none other than Tomas Vasconcelos, who was, of course, the head of the task force that brought Wallace Sulzer down. And look, if I didn't know more about this case, and just from like an outsider's glimpse, either of those plot lines makes a great story. The point here is, I think, it's both of those plot lines.
Yes, I agree.
I do genuinely think, I don't think anyone in the Brazilian military police or any of like his political enemies who were trying to bring him down were doing so because they thought Wallace Sulzer was wrong for what he was doing.
I totally agree.
Everyone in this story is just out for themselves.
And because he's dead and nothing's going to happen, there will be no consequence. Like, it doesn't really matter. And I can understand why you would spin that narrative.
Absolutely.
To his haters, Wallace Sulzer was a ruthless criminal. To his fans, he was a good man who paid the price for doing the right thing. Documentary maker Daniel Bugardo says that he tried to show both contradicting sides of this story. But even he isn't sure on which side he stands. While killing for ratings does sound like pure madness, Bugardo struggles to believe that corruption alone could explain absolutely everything. Because if it was just corruption, it would require a massive multi-layered conspiracy. One so deep and so widespread that it is just as unbelievable as the alternative.
Yeah, I think that's what makes this story so compelling, right? Mm. That if Wallace Sulzer really was killing for ratings, that is unbelievably shocking. But also the idea that this entire task force, all of the Brazilian military police, all of these politicians, everyone was in on bringing down the Brazilian Nancy Grace.
Mm.
It also just seems so batshit.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't know which it is. I think he was doing it. I think he was doing it. But yeah. It's a good story however you cut it.
Certainly. It's possible that Wallace ordered the killings, but for good reasons rather than ratings. I don't believe that's true. Because if that was true, he would be trying to get the drugs off the streets, wasn't he? And he wasn't doing that.
And look, even if you were like, his brother died of a drugs overdose, he's got this beef with drugs, he's taken down these drug dealers, and he's also using it for some ratings. I'm not saying it's okay, but I'm saying that is a much more sympathetic narrative than he's like, oh, but why are we shutting down these incredibly lucrative drug factories in the jungle? Let's just keep those going.
Exactly.
It really does twist that vigilante hero narrative.
And maybe, and this is very kind, and I'm going to immediately retract it as soon as I finish the sentence, but like perhaps, maybe, Wallace's intense hatred of drug traffickers, maybe that's how it started.
Mm.
And then he realized that playing God is really, really fun.
Yeah.
And it went from there, maybe.
I could believe that. Mm. I could believe that that's his, like, origin story into becoming the villain that he possibly was.
Mm-hmm. The Times, in particular, have said that cleaning up the streets of Manaus may have been a warped justification for Wallace Sulzer to himself. But when you consider that Wallace Sulzer's own gang, essentially, took over the business of the gangsters that they ousted, that's pretty telling, I think.
Mm, yeah.
And you can't ignore the irony of it, but I just don't think that it's untrue.
Yeah.
That's the most damning bit for me.
Yeah.
The rest, I mean, I believe all of it, but that is the nail in the coffin for his immortal soul, in my opinion.
But whether we believe it or not, stranger things have happened and they will happen again. And they might even be shown on Carnet Livre. Because following in his father's footsteps, Willis Sulzer revived the show in 2021 under the new name Signal Livre, which means free signal. With episodes available right now on YouTube, if you have some time on your hands. The creepy puppet, Gallerito, even made a return. And Willis has vowed to pursue a much lighter note, with far less blood than his predecessor.
Well, YouTube will demonetize you in a fucking heartbeat, so I'm not surprised.
Yeah, I think, you know, for Willis and Raphael, they make it clear that they really, really, really want to clear up their father's legacy,
mm-hmm.
because it's their legacy as well. I'm sure that's what Willis will be doing his best to do on this show.
Would you like to guess how many subscribers they have on YouTube?
It's either loads or none.
That's how numbers work, yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, it could be a standard number. It could be middling. I'm going to say, because that camera says 4K, is it 4K?
No.
Which is it?
7.28.
Thousand.
Mm.
Oh, there you go. Well, yeah. Not 7.28 people, is it? But yeah.
Billion. You know what? Not so bad.
That is not so bad. Mm. So, good luck. I don't know. I feel very confused by the end of this episode. Like, everyone's bad.
Mm.
And the people of Manaus are the ones who suffer the most because their town is just being ignored. Because you're right, it is a very isolated town. And we know that a lot of those Brazilian towns that are on the outskirts, particularly if there's a large, like, native population,
mm-hmm.
they are just kind of ignored by the, like, federal powers. And so absolutely can see Manaus being ignored in that way. And then it's this town that went into decline, right, from that rubber boom to nothing. And then it's just being descended upon by all of these drugs traffickers and becoming this port drug haven for all of these neighboring countries. It's just the people who are being stamped on. And every time they turn to believe in somebody, they also bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's depressing.
It is depressing. But yeah, Wallace Sulzer. Go check out the Netflix documentary. It is really good. Killer ratings. And like Daniel Bogota says, he doesn't really say which happens, like one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's because you can't. There's just so much contradictory evidence.
You can't. And also because, as you said, like both eventualities, both stories, both alternatives are both completely unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So it's so hard to try and put together any of it that makes sense because it is so difficult to get your head around that any of it happened at all.
Completely unbelievable and also yet completely believable. So that's the problem. So that is it, guys. That is our episode on Wallace Sulzer, a man who potentially, possibly, killed for ratings. But that's not quite as snappy, is it? snap.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah. And we butchered a bunch of Brazilian names, but we did try. We tried very hard.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next week for another episode of Red Handed. Goodbye.
Goodbye.